Tenta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bucket to Grease, Volume 3, by V.D. Bucket, narrated by David Vickery. Chapter 1. Rolling the Baby. Chewing distractedly on his bottom lip, Barry peered through the gloomy clutter of the downstairs storage space where the two of us had taken refuge from the women bickering in the kitchen. Dust spores danced in the dim light filtering in through the shuttered windows, firmly closed against the midday heat. It was difficult adjusting to the searing temperatures of May. At least the welcoming light breezes in the mountain village of Melly, where Marigold and I had made our home the previous September, spared us from the cloying sweatiness of the Greek coast. My brother-in-law, Barry, had arrived the previous evening, thinking it would be romantic to surprise his girlfriend Cynthia by turning up unexpectedly. Unfortunately, his whimsical gesture had fallen rather flat, since Cynthia was stuck on a 4-day guided coach tour, introducing the delights of Athens to a motley group of German tourists. Instead of getting intimate with Cynthia, Barry was reduced to sleeping on the sofa bed in my office. "This is a wonderful space. The thick walls ensure it's always cool and the arches add such character. It's a shame it only serves as a depository for junk and garden tools," Barry said, surveying the neglected space. "It's ripe for conversion into a traditional home." The traditional village house Marigold and I had purchased comprised an untouched ground floor below our 3-bedroom home. The 2 stories were not internally connected, the recently modernized first story being accessed by an outdoor stone staircase and topped with a roof terrace offering magnificent panoramic views. In the process of selling his flat and removal business in Manchester to make the move to Greece and go into partnership with Vangelis, the local builder, Barry had suggested converting the downstairs area into a separate abode. His suggestion would scupper my half-baked plan for a wine cellar, a plan that had progressed no further than storing 2 cases of Little Red, purchased on special offer, the bottles still in their cardboard boxes. The addition of 2 rather mildewed cushions atop said boxes of wine provided relatively comfortable seating as we mulled the practicalities of Barry's conversion project. "Marigold would miss her extra virgin," I sighed, pointing at the huge wooden barrel containing 500 litres of the local elixir. "I suppose you could build around it and turn it into a decorative feature. It's in the ideal spot for where a bathroom should be, as the space aligns well with your upstairs plumbing," Barry said. We both stared at the immovable barrel of olive oil, trying to imagine it wedged in between a shower and a toilet. "Perhaps the barrel could be turned into a Japanese bathtub once all the oil has been used," I suggested, recalling how Marigold had always hankered after an ofuro soaking tub. "An outdoor hosepipe would be better for shifting the grime at the end of a hard day's labouring," Barry pointed out, "and a Japanese soaking tub isn't very practical in an area with such a precarious water supply." "That's true. Even with a new backup water tank, we still need to ration our use if the water is off for more than a couple of days," I agreed, thinking if Barry went ahead with his plans, we would need yet another spare tank. "I've got a ring in my pocket," Barry confided. "A plan to propose. I would rather value your advice, Victor." "I think going down on one knee is still in vogue," I advised. "Not about the proposal, about filling Cynthia in on my idea to convert this space into living quarters before I pop the question. I'm not sure if she'd find it a bit off-putting living underneath my sister." "It may not suit Cynthia. She could well consider it a bit claustrophobic in the familial sense. It certainly has connotations of a teenager living in their parents' basement," I pointed out. Even though Barry was in his early 50s, I surmised that his plans to up sticks was as much influenced by his wish to remain close to Marigold as it was to formalise his relationship with Cynthia. "Anyway, it's all rather moot at this point," Barry said. "I hope you got the ring on sale and return," I interrupted. I didn't mean the proposal was moot. I do plan to pop the question. But since you've raised the matter, Argos does have an excellent refund policy. I mean, it may require fighting our way through endless reams of unfathomable Greek bureaucracy, Barry said. Even allowing for a brown envelope, it's quite impossible unless you convert, I said. Convert to what? Barry said, his scrunched forehead indicating bafflement. Greek Orthodox, I said, even though I'm well in with Papas Andreas after he blessed our house. You would still need to make a public declaration before he'd let you marry in the church. I think we're talking at cross purposes, Victor. I hardly think a religious conversion is necessary to turn this space into a habitable abode. Vangelis and Spiros are seasoned operators when it comes to working the system. Ah, I thought you were talking about the Greek bureaucracy involved in getting married over here, I said. I looked it up online. It's possible to have a simple ceremony of the Greek equivalent of the town hall, Barry said. The Vima Haio, I said, volunteering the correct Greek word. That's the place, Barry agreed. I just need to sort out a license and have my divorce decree translated. No need for any religious conversion. Even if you converted, you still wouldn't have a clue what was going on. The service is conducted in ancient Greek, I said. I thought that by now the town hall would have got the hang of modern Greek, Barry sighed. I'm talking about a church wedding. The whole thing was a bit of an eye-opener when Kostis married Eleni. Kostis? Barry questioned. The son of Nikos and Dina at the taverna, I reminded him. I know who he is, but I remember Marigold telling me they were planning an autumn wedding. Eleni's pregnant, so they had to bring the date forward. They got married at the end of February. It was a rush job in the circumstances, and Dina wasn't at all happy, I said, desperately trying to recall the Greek words for a shotgun wedding that I had duly memorized back in February. I thought Dina would be over the moon to know she'll be a grandmother soon, Barry said, in surprise. Oh, she is. She's delirious with joy. I meant she wasn't happy with a month. Traditionally, it is bad luck to marry in February. Nikos only talked around in the end because it isn't a leap year. There were no free spots in the church in early March, and then, of course, it's verbatim to get married during the 40 days of Lent. That's probably just as well. You can imagine, enforced fasting would put a bit of a damper on the celebrations, I explained, thinking that all Greek festivities tended to revolve around vast platters of food. My relief at no longer being obliged to fry chips every night is nothing compared to the sheer joy Dina feels at the weekends now that her knifey has taken over the drudgery of kitchen duties. Knifey? Barry asked. Daughter-in-law, I clarified. Dina is in her element, good-heartedly bossing Eleni around and fussing over Kostis on the rare occasions he doesn't pull a disappearing act. I had spent 8 long weeks over the winter standing in as a chef or kitchen skivvy in the local taverna, whilst Dina was out of action due to a broken arm. Admittedly, there were times when I felt a pang of regret that I was now once again simply a customer, rather than attached to the deep fat fryer. My stint in the taverna had helped me to develop a deep sense of camaraderie with the local villagers, and had earned me a special place in Dina's heart. I thought Eleni was a schoolteacher, Barry said, obviously confused as to why she would be skivvying in the taverna. She is, but of course Nikos and Dina are pressuring the newlyweds to move to Meli and live with them. Eleni is committed to seeing out the school year in town, but has agreed to make the move once the baby comes along. For now, the couple spend their weekends in Meli, and Eleni is obliged to do all the drudge work in the taverna to help out Dina. Naturally, Kostis, in his role as pampered son, isn't expected to lift a finger. It sounds like a very old-fashioned way of going about things, Barry said. It's the traditional way of the village, and at least Eleni lucked out by landing Dina as her pathera. Barry nodded his agreement that Dina was indeed an ideal mother-in-law, warm, kind, and welcoming. I continued by saying, I expect it will be difficult for Eleni to adjust and conform to the expectations of small village life. She tried to put her foot down over the bed-making ceremony, insisting such superstitious nonsense could be dispensed with. She argued there was no need to borrow a baby to roll on the bed as a lucky symbol of fertility, since she was already pregnant, but Dina overruled her as the scan showed she's having a girl. The bed-making ceremony? Barry queried, with a raised eyebrow. Although I wasn't included in the all-woman gathering, Marigold regaled me with the details of what went down. Dina insisted on going ahead with the whole rigmarole, hoping to stack the odds in her favour that Eleni will produce the all-important grandson on her second attempt. Since there are no babies in Melli, Dina borrowed the grandson of Kyria Koboyenopulio to be rolled symbolically on Costas's single bed above the taverna. It turned into a bit of a disaster when the boisterous borrowed toddler leapt head-first onto the rice-strewn bed, promptly knocking over the symbolic jar of honey and greedily scoffing all the kufeta. The kufeta. Sugared almonds. They seem to feature quite heavily in all manner of Greek celebrations, I said. Anyway, the sticky symbol of fertility screamed blue murder when Kyria Koboyenopulio dragged him outside and sluiced him down under the hosepipe to remove all traces of honeyed rice. I hope Marigold won't insist on emulating that particular Greek tradition if Cynthia says yes to my proposal, Barry said, with a grimace. I rather think you're both a bit past the baby stage, I sighed in relief. Speaking of traditions, Barry continued, I'd like you to be my best man. I'd be honoured, I replied. Our conversation was interrupted by the rattling of the storage door. Not a word to Marigold, Barry warned me. She'd never get over the disappointment if Cynthia turns me down. Chapter 2. A Lesson in Sweet Nothings. Marigold's withering look held a hint of presumption that we had been up to no good. Her eyes panned suspiciously over the boxes of wine as though we were a pair of disreputable day tipplers, before she herded us out of the storage room like a couple of recalcitrant sheep. Barry, you must take control of Cynthia's mutant cat. It appears to be attempting to mate with a head of broccoli in the vegetable patch. Marigold commanded. I, for one, don't fancy eating anything that Kuneli has tried to copulate with, even if it is boiled. Even though Marigold was clearly referring to a boiled head of broccoli, her words provoked a welcome image of the boiled mutant cat. I'll sort out some netting over the vegetable patch, Barry volunteered. I considered it a tad unfair that Marigold was holding Barry responsible for the antics of Cynthia's vile rapist cat, though I reflected that if he'd had the good sense to warn Cynthia of his impending arrival, she could have left him a key. She had a terrible habit of letting the ghastly creature roam free whenever her work schedule required her to stay away overnight. On his last trip over, Barry had created a cat flap in Cynthia's kitchen door, allowing her cats easy access to the house. Unfortunately, a feral intruder took advantage, leaving a trail of destruction in Cynthia's kitchen before attacking Kuneli, the mutant tabby that had ravished our imported cat, Clawsome, resulting in a collection of kittens. The mangled ear that resulted from Kuneli's encounter with the feral intruder did nothing to enhance the already revolting appearance of the reprobate feline. The foul-smelling liquid secreted in the kitchen eventually revealed the intruder had been a polecat marking its territory, rather than a random stray, necessitating the speedy boarding up of the cat flap. Marigold, worried that a polecat may inveigle its way into our house and attack the kittens or our two imported cats, immediately insisted that I install cat-friendly sonic devices to act as a deterrent against invasive polecats. I was currently awaiting the delivery of a replacement brand, since the ones I'd plugged in played havoc with the hearing aid of our elderly neighbour, Kyria Maria. Every time she stepped foot in her garden, she burst into a startled dance, shaking her head wildly, as though to dislodge bees that had taken up residence in her ears. I hoped she didn't have any plans to come calling before the replacement sonic devices were delivered. I'd hate to be responsible for her hearing aid exploding in situ. "Did you get rid of Doreen?" I asked my wife, reluctant to head back indoors if her tedious friend was still lurking in the kitchen. Barry and I had made a hasty escape when the two women started bickering over the provenance of the foreign meal that would feature at the next gathering of the expat monthly dining club. Marigold, keen to extend her circle of friends, had signed us both up to this newly formed club, despite my objections. I found such occasions to be nothing more than a ruse for an evening of one-upmanship, with an inevitable comparison of house prices. I would much prefer to spend my free time conversing with Panos or Demetris than stuck next to Doreen's husband, Norman. The man was such a bore, he blended into the background like nondescript wallpaper, his conversation as dull as a bowl of congealed porridge. Marigold was prepared to overlook what she considered the minor irritations of insipid company if it helped maintain our social standing amongst the small expat community. Naturally, I must humour my wife if I wish to avoid ending up in the divorce courts. "Doreen has gone home, Victor. We decided she would host a French-themed dinner for our next soiree, as she fancies experimenting with snails," Marigold said. "That woman has pretensions above her culinary skills," I sneered, recalling her disastrous attempt to recreate Peking duck using a little chicken. "I very much doubt that she knows her way around a good espagnol. As for her escargots, I'd put money on them coming out of a tin. Can you really picture her crawling about to collect fresh snails, even though there is an abundance of them slithering around the local countryside?" "Fresh snails? Count me in!" Barry piped up, entering the kitchen, clutching the cat-ravaged head of broccoli. "Vangelis told me they're considered a local delicacy. How about we go on an early morning snail-collecting mission tomorrow, Victor?" "Don't expect me to cook them. I'm having nothing to do with it," Marigold said emphatically. "You can leave it to me, Marigold. Although I've never collected live snails, I've spent enough time inspecting fancy French kitchens in my illustrious career as a public health inspector to pick up a thing or two about optimum methods of snail preparation," I said, agreeing to a spot of early morning foraging for gastropod mollusks with Barry the next day. Making a mental note to select a choice recipe from one of Marigold's extensive collection of Greek cookery books, I reflected that Barry was certainly becoming more adventurous food-wise these days. "Were there any phone calls whilst I was downstairs?" I asked Marigold. "I was keen to hear back from a local tour company that had interviewed me for a part-time position as a tour guide. Since taking early retirement, I had no intention of remaining idle, but found myself somewhat at a loose end since my chefing services were no longer in demand at the Taverna. I had read up extensively on the history of the local area during the winter, and was ready to share my considerable knowledge with interested tourists who were bound to be impressed by my mastery of historical facts. There were no calls for you, Victor, but Geraldine phoned me for a chat," Marigold said, referring to her best friend in England who had spent a week with us in Greece the previous year. "Is she still pining over Papas Andreas?" I asked curiously. Although an electrical current had sparked between the pair of them the moment they first locked eyes, any question of romance between the pet food taster and the priest were surely doomed. "Geraldine is comparing their illicit long-distance romance to the Thornbirds. Having spent the weekend binge-watching old DVDs, she rather fancies Papas Andreas in the role of Rolf de Bricassart," Marigold chuckled. "Even if the Papas could be persuaded to shave off his straggly beard, he's no Richard Chamberlain." I nodded my agreement that by no stretch of the imagination could Papas Andreas be compared to the heartthrob film star. "Still, I suppose it's all very harmless since they reside in different countries. At least whilst Geraldine is fixated, she isn't dating unsuitable men," Marigold continued. I made a mental note to try and get out the next English lesson Papas Andreas was badgering me about, unaware that his motive in wishing to expand his English vocabulary was to further his illicit wooing of Geraldine via clandestine telephone calls, I had agreed to a spot of private tutoring. I had prepared an interesting lesson on homophones for our first meeting, but Papas Andreas blithely brushed off my attempts to explain the difference between sweet and sweet, only interested in memorizing stock phrases of sweet nothings he could smooth-talk long distance. Hopefully the arrival of his telephone bill would put an end to these mushy shenanigans. In the meantime, I had no desire to coach him in honeyed words. Anyone who chanced to overhear our lesson could get totally the wrong idea, even though I had cleared up the earlier misunderstanding that I was a homosexual. "Vangelis is going to pop round later and give us a quote," Marigold said. "I can do any jobs you need doing, Marigold. Since Cynthia won't be back from Athens for another couple of days, I might as well keep busy," Barry volunteered. "I'm up for building you a shady arbor in the garden that you could train climbers on." "That sounds delightful, Barry, and certainly far more useful than that outside bread oven. I knew Victor would never bother to use it. I've asked Vangelis to give us a quote for a pool, though," Marigold said, at least having the grace to blush. Marigold had raised the issue of sinking a swimming pool in the garden several times, despite my objections that a pool was an expensive folly in a village with a very precarious water supply. Marigold was like a dog with a bone, refusing to drop the idea. "It's so very hot already, and it's only May. I really do think we will need a pool in the height of summer," Marigold wheedled. "You can ask Vangelis to give you a quote for an outdoor shower instead. I have no intention of shelling out good money on such a frivolous luxury as a pool," I said sternly. "I'm with Victor on this," Barry agreed. "You're only a 30-minute drive from the coast. There's absolutely no need for a pool. The Greeks manage perfectly well without them." "If you're so keen on a pool, then I suggest you make friends with Harold," I added, referring to a ghastly expat who constantly boasted he had the only pool in Melli. Marigold's face fell at my stubborn refusal to countenance her pool fantasy. Deciding to put an end to her nonsense once and for all, I raised some obvious drawbacks she hadn't considered. "If we had a swimming pool, you would never be able to get Kyria Maria out of it, and I'm sure you'd object to getting into water contaminated by Guzim's sneaking nocturnal baths in it." The practical objections I voiced were met with resigned annoyance from Marigold. With her dream thwarted, she agreed it would be difficult to camouflage a pool from our ancient neighbour's prying eyes, and she shuddered in horror at the thought of swimming in the residue of Guzim's dusty grime, having noticed the tendency of the local Albanian men to don their swim shorts over their underpants. The ringing of the telephone put an end to our petty argument. It was excellent news. The local tour company were phoning to offer me a position. Readily accepting their offer to lead a coach full of tourists to ancient Olympia once a week, I hastened to my office to read up on salient facts pertaining to the ancient ruins. Chapter 3. Scarlet Kokinos. With Greece due to host the Olympic Games the following year, I considered it imperative that I acquaint myself with the history of the Games in preparation for my role as a tour guide to their original birthplace. Fascinated by the once popular sport of chariot racing, I found myself scribbling wry observations in the margins of my book, hoping to turn them into amusing quips to entertain the holidaymakers. I was intrigued to note that ancient Greek women had been generally excluded from watching sporting events in which athletes competed naked. I was pretty sure that if Marigold had been determined to watch a bout of ancient wrestling, she would have insisted the competitors donned some clothes. Women had been allowed to watch the chariot races, no doubt because the charioteers were suitably attired in a long-sleeved robe known as a cistus, not too dissimilar in style from the type of vestment favoured by the modern-day Greek clergy. I pondered the notion that Geraldine had perhaps spied the priest accepting a lift on one of the villagers' donkeys, and fancied Papas Andreas as a modern-day charioteer. Discovering that mule cart racing was once an Olympic sport, I considered that perhaps its modern equivalent might be a tractor dash. I could picture a victorious Panos stepping down from his trusty tractor to be crowned with an olive wreath, accepting the tumultuous applause as his due. My mental image was somewhat ruined, since no matter how hard I tried, I could not imagine Panos without his wellies, not a good look when paired with a flowing robe. Cynthia had warned me that I would be expected to be as knowledgeable about toilet stops, souvenir shops, and local lunch menus as I was about the history of our destination. I made a mental note to extract the pertinent information from the coach driver, who would most likely be experienced in these matters. I would make a point of arriving early for my first tour to allow enough time to treat the coach driver to a Greek coffee whilst picking his brains. I was so engrossed in my research that I lost track of time, until I was interrupted by Milton sticking his head around my office door, announcing,
"I hope you don't mind my impromptu visit, old chap. Marigold let me in, what?"
Spotting the pile of books on my desk, he added,
"If this is a bad time, just say."
"Not at all. Take the weight off," I offered, kicking a pile of Barry's clothes and a surplus kitten under the sofa bed to make room for my guest. "I'm just reading up on ancient Olympia in preparation for my new job as a tour guide."
"Excellent, excellent. I dare myself if the old hip could stand the pressure of traipsing around all those ruins,"
Milton said approvingly. Milton and his wife Edna, a pair of impoverished pensioners, were part of Melly's small community of expat Brits. The devoted couple had been swindled out of their life savings when Milton had fallen for an early internet scam exploiting a sorry saga of destitute Liberian orphans. Forced to live frugally, Milton hoped to reverse their fortunes by writing a volume of erotica under a pen name. Marigold and I found it hard to conceal our mirth when we pictured Edna serving as Milton's muse. When Marigold first discovered Milton's literary ambitions, she had worried he may steal my thunder by penning a more interesting book about moving to Greece than my own work in progress. But fortunately, he was convinced there was more money to be made in salacious literature than in the upsticks genre. Only Marigold and Barry knew about my scribbles under the pseudonym of V.D. Bucket, the unfortunate name I was saddled with after being abandoned in a bucket at the railway station as a baby. Marigold, as an obsessive fan of moving abroad books, encouraged my writing, though she was banned from perusing the pages after blackmailing Barry into feeding my first few chapters into the shredder, telling her brother I had portrayed her in an unflattering light. After the obligatory small talk, Milton announced he had finally finished his volume of erotica. Reaching into the depths of the little carrier bag he was clutching, he pulled out a rather tatty collection of coffee-smeared handwritten pages. In spite of knowing nothing of my own literary endeavours, Milton proffered the pages, saying,
"I rather hope I can persuade you to cast your eyes over my book and give your opinion."
"I'm afraid erotica isn't really my cup of tea," I objected, mortified at the thought of perusing the pages. I would never be able to look Edna in the eye ever again if I became intimately acquainted with the myriad ways in which she had inspired Milton's amatory words. "As you can see from my reading pile, I'm really much more into historical matter. Marigold likes to jest that you'll always find me with my nose stuck in a dreary, fact-filled tome," I added, pointing to the current reading matter piled high on my desk.
"Oh, a pity. You strike me as the pedantic type who would be sure to pick up on the odd typo or grammatical blooper," Milton replied.
"I rather think you would need to type up your book before any typos could be spotted," I pointed out pedantically. "I don't think there's much call for handwritten manuscripts these days."
"Ah, I did wonder about that. So you think I should type it all up before seeking a second opinion or before unleashing it onto the publishing world?"
"Most definitely. I can't see it receiving much interest if an agent needs to get to grips with your handwriting," I said decisively, glad that his appalling script offered an out.
"I suppose you're right, but it will take forever. It will have to be a bit of a two-finger jobby. Of course Edna is a proficient typist, but I was hoping to spare her blushes."
My guilt, deftly dodging editing Milton's pet porn project, receded. I considered it a bit rich that he would want to spare his wife's blushes, but was perfectly willing to embarrass me by subjecting me to his lewd imaginings. "I think it's definitely best to turn your handwritten pages into a neatly typed manuscript before you even think about the editing process," I advised again, staring at his dog, or more likely cat-eared effort.
"I don't suppose Marigold would be interested in giving her opinion from a woman's perspective," Milton suggested.
"Only if you're keen on the idea of excessive exclamation marks being added to the end of each sentence," I said, hoping this would be enough to put him off the idea. It's a particular quirk of hers." Whilst Milton stuffed the papers back into his carrier bag in a random fashion, I asked him if he'd settled on a suitable pseudonym.
"Ah, indeed! I have given my chosen name of Scarlet a clever Greek twist," Milton said, without elaborating.
"How so?" I inquired.
"I'm considering using the Greek translation of..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?